Fluffin' Fuckatash. What are we listening to? The Movie Rob Minute Podcast. Keep on listening.
Indeed, that's all, folks.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 85 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today is John from the Dirty Hair. John, what? That's not John. You're not John.
No.
Sorry, it's Alan. Alan Sanders.
No, I'm stuck in the building.
Oh, Alan Sanders. From The Wilder Ride. So welcome back to the show in place of John, who unfortunately couldn't be with us on this lovely Friday.
That's all right. You know what? I cannot begrudge his absence because we get to at least close out one of the great just moments in the movie. There's so many great moments, but I would have hated if I had gone away yesterday and not finished Ellis's last few words.
Right. Okay. I can completely understand. I mean, are there bad moments in this movie?
You know what? You and I were texting back and forth about it, and I said, I can't think of a single bad minute in this movie at all. Like, every minute I go watch, I'm like, oh, I could talk about this minute. Oh, I could talk about this minute, which is, I guess, why you're doing what you're doing.
Right. I can obviously talk about every minute. You know, so far I've talked about 84 minutes, and I, you know, have another about 40, almost 40 to go. So I'm pretty safe that I can get through those. There, I think there will be something to talk about. You know, I haven't yet reached an episode where I was just like, oh, there's nothing to talk about here. But then again, as you know, I like to pad my conversations with things people don't expect. And just you wait. We're gonna get to something today that you're not gonna expect. I can guarantee you.
You know, I think you're correct. You will get me with something that I hadn't planned on.
Yes. And but that's the fun of it. You know, hopefully everyone listening is also enjoying to listen to the shock and awe. You know, from all of my guests, you know, how you know, even someone like you who has recorded with me numerous times and you know where my mind goes for certain things, they're just sometimes you just don't know what to anticipate.
I have to tell you, we closed off last episode yesterday. I was waiting for you to give me the lesson on capiche. And we didn't even talk about it. We didn't even talk about this Italian slang for you got it, the whole story. You get what I'm saying? And like, you didn't even talk about it.
Well, because we didn't have time.
So I guess
we
dodged that.
We talked for almost an hour without getting to capiche. Or maybe it was like 45 minutes. I don't remember how long we talked for yesterday.
You know, I'm not complaining. I don't have to edit it. I enjoy the
conversation. Well, I don't mind editing it because when I edit the conversation between us, I get to hear it again. You know, so there's nothing wrong with that. And I get to, you know.
Nothing wrong.
And I get to, you know. Cut out all the bad parts, which, you know, thankfully there usually aren't very many, you know, so
that's an important skill to have.
Yes. Well, especially when talking to someone who's a radio personality. So, you know, there, if I'm going to cut anything, it's going to be what I say, not what you say. You're a little more averse to this than I am. A little bit. Would you like to say something today about capiche?
Thank
then?
You very much.
Just because you missed it. It's fine.
I just did kind of. I all I did was like, because I grew up with my dad being Polish American, Polish on that side, but he would also say that. And I'm like, why do you say that? And he's like, well, I just grew up with friends from different parts of the country. It's always capiche. And so I was waiting for that with
the hand gesture wouldn't work too, because we're doing this, you know, the Italian in you. So.
Well, yeah, but you can convey that. I can convey to the audience. I can say capiche. Yeah, you know what
okay.
I'm saying?
If you say so. All right, so we'll talk about capiche then.
We'll find out.
We will talk about capiche.
How's that?
Okay, I'll make you happy. Okay, so what does capiche mean?
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, it's a Italian American slang that usually means, do you get it? Do you got the whole story? Do you understand? I'm
well, yes,
giving
and
it
no.
to you. Do you
are
get
correct
what I'm
and
telling
incorrect
you?
At the same time. First of all, it comes from an Italian word, which is capire.
I have
capire. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that that's how it's pronounced. I could be wrong. And it means to understand. And already in the 1700s, it was used in a lot of literature. And it was picked up as a popular slang English word in, let's see if you can guess what decade. What decade do you think they started with the capiche? Yeah.
Capiche? Probably around or after the probably after the Depression. So in the
You said after the Depression, so I'll give you points for that. It started, you know, around the 1940s. So you're very close. It's very good. You know, that probably has a lot to do with maybe the mafia and things like that. You know, reminds us of scenes from The Godfather and stuff like that, where you can just see, you know, the character or a character like the Godfather just saying, capiche, you understand what I'm talking about? You know, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And there are so many different spellings for this word. And nobody knows which is the actual correct way to spell it. You can spell it C-A-P-I-C-H-E, C-A-P-I-S-C-E, C-A-P-E-E-S-H, C-A-P-I-S-C-E-H-E. Okay, but nobody really knows which is actually correct. So it doesn't really matter, because I think, as you said, it's the idea of talking about it and using the hand gestures when you say it. You know, not just one, it's both. You have to say both. You know, capiche? Do you understand? obviously, it sometimes it gained a lot more popularity due to the way that Italian Americans and mafia men are shown in movies, and you know, basically, it's been turned into something that, as you said, is completely American. It's not just thought of as Italian American. It's used all over the place.
Right. No, absolutely. It's a slang that I grew up with. I didn't have any Italian friends or any that I knew of, as far as like, I didn't live in Brooklyn. I didn't live in like Little Italy. I mean, I grew up outside of Detroit, so I wasn't.
Me too.
I wasn't
Me too.
Around a lot of folks who grew up with an Italian heritage, but I knew what capiche meant. I mean,
right.
Believe
but the
me,
question
we all
is, did you know it because your father would use it, or did you know it because you saw it in movies? What do you think?
I knew it because my father would use it, and I thought it was an English word.
Oh, okay.
Like, I had no idea it came from Italian until, thankfully, the Italian mobster kind of movies, and you go, oh, wait a minute, I know that word.
Well, maybe they're just trying to be more American, and that's why, you know,
I don't think so.
No, but if you're saying that you didn't know, so how would you then know that that's where it comes from? It's not like in movies like The Godfather, they're going to say, capiche, this is an Italian word, capiche.
Okay, so here we go. You're trying to throw something logical at me, and I will tell you the reason I thought that there was no question that it came from Italy or it came from Italian is because the mobster movies, they all dressed like they were so much older, so it must have been a long time ago, and it didn't bother, like, as a young brain, didn't occur to me that you could have a modern day movie being made and just costumed a long time ago. I just assumed, well, this is a long time ago, so that must be where it came from.
Okay, that's fair. That's, you know, that's the mind of a kid.
Like, exactly.
Which,
like, look how long ago that was, Dad.
I mentioned it at some point, I don't remember when, that I used to always think that in movies, when a character would die, they would actually use like a dummy or a mannequin or something like that. I did believe that the actors are pretending to be dead. You know, I always just assumed that. It didn't matter how they died. You know, we're not talking about special effects and stuff like that. You know, just someone even having a heart attack. You know, you see the body on the ground. That's not the real actor. That's what I always thought. Because, you know, they have to hold their breath.
Isn't it amazing? One of the things I used to always as a kid, it would confuse me, is if I liked an actor.
And not laugh when they're lying on the ground.
And right. You can't move. No, if I saw an actor I really liked, but as a kid, I just assumed that that's who the person was. I never thought of it as somebody pretending to be somebody. And then when I would see that same actor, but playing a completely different role, or maybe even like a villain, it would bother me as a kid. I'm like, wait a minute, Han Solo can't be a bad guy. I mean, he's Han Solo. Sure. Like, well,
Han Solo can't be Indiana Jones.
He's playing a role. Well, and that's it. I would have confusion as a kid because I would so identify with the character versus the actor and couldn't separate the two. I can now, but when I was a kid, it used to be really bothersome when I would see somebody I loved in one movie be somebody I didn't like or treated people badly. I'm like, what are you doing? You're right. The good
or,
guy.
I'm sure that could work the other way also. You have someone who is constantly playing bad guys, and then you see him in a good role. Like, for instance, perfect example, you know, in Platoon, the fact that Tom Berenger and Willem Dafoe were both miscast, you know, where they were cast in roles that you wouldn't expect them to be in. And that's why they gave such great performances.
Mm-hmm.
you know, Willem Dafoe is mm-hmm. known as playing evil characters, you know, even before 1986. And Tom Berenger was always the, you know, just the all around, all American fun guy, you know, a nice guy and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. to switch those roles, I mean, they both got Oscar nominations. They were both great there. You know, too bad neither of them won. But yeah,
good point. Good point.
Yes, for sure. Playing but against time. We're actually here to talk about Die Hard. You know.
Well, it's the end of the week. We needed something to segue back into it.
Episode 85 begins with Ellis raising the stakes and ends with Hans letting everyone hear the screams of the audience. Yeah, that's how you want to end the week. with lots of screaming.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We're definitely going to end on a crescendo.
Yes, it reminds me even the movie The Last Boy Scout. You know, where one of the bad guys says to Bruce Willis' character, you know, I want to make you scream, and he says, just play some rap music. You know.
Yeah. Talk about, you brought it up. Talk about an underrated Bruce Willis movie. Love The Last Boy Scout.
I loved it. I actually just rewatched it last week. I don't even remember. I watched so many movies, I don't remember when I saw it, but I saw it recently. And I just loved watching it again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw it in the theater.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it's one of those movies that is really stupid, but it's just so much fun to watch.
I don't think I got the humor and the wit behind the writing when I first saw it because I was so disappointed leaving the theater, and I almost didn't watch it again. And when I did, I was like, wait a minute, I didn't remember it being this good. And then I watched it a third time. I was like, oh my gosh, I get the jokes are being set up for later. And it's just, to me, it's just amazing. I love the Last Boy Scout's just amazing. But again, we're not here to talk about it.
But we're able to go off a little bit on things. So
it is Bruce Willis. At least it's more relevant.
Yes, yes, it's connected. It's connected. It's all connected. And so yesterday we ended the minute with our good friend the idiot Ellis trying to convince John to, you know, give himself up. And
give up the detonators at least.
Yes.
Stop doing this. Well, stop messing around.
Himself. Give him up himself, not just the detonators. So he starts interjecting here. He goes, I'm putting my life on the line for you, pal. Interrupts him and goes, Ellis, listen to me very carefully. John, shut up, Ellis. Just shut your mouth. Put Hans back on the line. Hans, this shithead does not know what kind of man you are, but I do. Listen. And at this point, Hans responds and goes, good, then you'll give us what we want and save your friend's life. You're not part of this equation. It's time you realize that. Now, I mean, Ellis is just really stupid. And he's getting really stupider and stupider as these minutes are going along. You know, he's saying things that he really doesn't understand the stakes here.
No, I don't think he realized. When you say that he's up the stakes, he really has. I mean, I think we're already there on Hans's side of the aisle, but here he is making this grand pronouncement. I'm putting my life on the line for you, pal. And then he's so happy with saying, like, hey, it was a good raise, wasn't it? And he like even raises his eyebrows and almost smiles at Hans, like, did you like that? That was pretty good, wasn't it?
Right. Exactly. You know, he I guess he's a wannabe thespian.
Yeah.
You know?
He doesn't. He thinks he's in performance mode. He thinks he's performing in front of, like we said this earlier in the week, in front of the executive or the boardroom. He's trying to win the business, and he's used to playing that kind of role to get the contract signed. It's never, and you can tell, it's not even entered his mind that he's about to be short of this world.
Yes, correct. And, I mean, Ellis just, he's clueless here. You know, it makes you wonder, did Hans at some point even threaten him? Probably not. Mm-hmm. You know, as you said, this is just a performance for him. So who knows? And then at this point, Ellis interjects again and goes, hey, what am I, method actor, Hans? Mm-hmm. Babe, put away the gun. This is radio, not television, which is pretty funny that he says it that way. He's basically saying to himself, he's you know, we're podcasting and, you know, we're doing the same thing. This is radio. This isn't television. They can't see us. But the idea is you know, what Ellis is trying to do here is pretend that something is happening there in order for John to possibly give himself up or give up the detonators or try to save Ellis in some way, shape, or form, which, I mean, John knows that that's not going to fly. He knows if he does that, he's a goner.
Yeah, I don't see it as him pretending that because Hans does bring a gun out. I mean, I really do think that I think that may be the first moment that Ellis is like having a second doubt about like, what are you doing? I'm selling this. You don't have to help. I don't need the visual because we're on radio.
No, I got to disagree with you on this one. He still is clueless. He doesn't think that Hans is actually, you know, there's a gun on the table, but he's still acting.
I don't think that's. I'm gonna disagree. We're gonna argue on this one.
Okay, let's argue. Let's say
This is not helping to sell the intensity to John. Ellis is realizing. Why do you need a gun? Well, I mean, it's not gonna work. He's not. I don't think he's doing that for John's benefit. That's a two-way mic open. He's left the mic on, so it's not. He's having to do push to talk, and you're hearing for some reason bidirectional communication on a walkie-talkie because they're both able to talk and receive without pressing the button. But correct. I think Ellis is, hey, man, look, I got it under control. You don't need to wave a gun in front of me. He can't see it. I don't think that's helping. Bruce Willis already knows what's going on. He doesn't need to raise the stakes for John. He doesn't. I just think this is Ellis going, guy, I got it. You know, don't help me. I know what I'm doing here.
No. I disagree with you on this one.
People to weigh in on this episode. Yeah, people need to weigh in.
Yeah, that's right. I really think that this is just a continuation of his play acting here. You know, he obviously Hans is fingering the gun and he lifts it up and then puts it down on the table. Yes. But I don't think that, you know, I think that Ellis is using this in order to try to get John to change something. He's not doing it because he himself thinks that Hans is going to do something. You know, the fact that Hans has the gun there might give him the idea to use this as a prop, you know, for Ellis to use it as a prop in his speech. But I don't think he's saying it to Hans. He's saying it to John.
But why does he say the line then? What says, do you think I'm a method actor? He goes, what do you think? A method actor? What is the method style of acting?
Method style of acting is to really do something.
Right. So he's like, hey, you don't have to really threaten me with a gun. I get it. I don't need you to do that. Like, he's aware that Hans is doing something threatening. He's like, what am I, a method? You put away
no,
the gun,
but he's
Hans.
Saying this to John. He's not saying it to Hans.
Oh, he's not. The microphone's not anywhere close to him. He's still pointing it at Hans.
It's still going to catch his voice. It's not like it,
I don't think he realizes he's not performing. Remember, when he's performing, he's got the handset and he's playing with it and he's performing into it and he's talking into it. Right now, it's not pointed to him. He's pointing it to Hans in the middle of the room.
You have a good point, but I'm not gonna give it to you because I truly believe. I mean, I've seen this movie so many times. I've seen the scene. He is still part of the act. He continues his act until the very end of this minute. You know, when it finally dawns on him that his acting is not going to help him anymore. Mm. He continues to act. So he's saying this in order to get John to do something because he's basically saying, John, listen, what I'm saying to Hans is I'm not a method actor here. This is a real life situation. I'm really scared that something's going to happen to me.
Well, one other thing to take note of, and I'm not going to be able to convince you. I think I've given you compelling reasons why I see it the way I do.
And you don't think I've given you compelling reasons back?
No.
I'm not trying to convince you.
Look, I'll give you
you're an ass.
One more visual. I'll give you one more visual clue.
Okay.
That he is suddenly sweating it, even if it's a little unconscious. The very beginning of the scene when he's like smiling and he winks and he nods, his brow is not shiny. His hair doesn't look like it's kind of sticking to him. It doesn't look like he's got any kind of sweat or stickiness. And when he comes in for that close-up afterwards, shut up, Ellis, you know he's going to kill you. And he's like, John, how could you say that? And then the close-up, he's shiny. His hair looks like it's sticking to him. He's suddenly sweating. He's panicked. He realizes it's not going the way he wanted it to go.
No, you see that later on when he realizes that John is not talking to him anymore. But not yet.
Right after he says, shut up, Ellis. And that's the first time he gets the microphone.
No, he gets it later. He takes it later.
Oh, it's right here. It's right here. You no, just started talking about it.
I see what you're talking about, but no. This isn't it. People are listening to this and going, what are these two assholes arguing about?
All right. We'll pull back and say this. I see Ellis as suddenly going, wait a minute, I don't need the gun. I got it, you know, and that's the first time I think he's getting a little nervous. He may not think he's going to be killed, but he's like, what are you doing waving the gun? You know, I got it. He's not doing that for John. I think he's dealing that to Hans. He's specifically saying, Hans, I got it. You don't have to wave the gun around, Bubba. I got this.
No, okay, so wait, what you're also saying is he's gonna start sweating within 4 seconds. You know, his brow is going to be – you're saying in 4 seconds. That's probably all from the lighting.
Well, you can say 4 seconds because we're breaking it down. But in movie time, it looks like he's – and that extreme close-up of him – he looks like a nervous rabbit that's perspiring, and he's still trying to smile through it.
No, that's later. He's not smiling here. You know, when he's
I'm talking about when it comes back to him, because we're arguing about whether or not the whole method acting is for John's benefit, and I'm saying it's not. It has nothing to do with John. And then he goes back into performance, but he's already starting to sweat it now because of the gun, and because he just got done hearing Bruce yell at him, you know, shut up, Ellis. You know, they're going to kill you. He's like, how can you say that after all these years?
He hasn't. No, but we haven't gotten there yet.
Well, I'm ahead of you because I know where you were going. I'm watching it.
No, okay, so am I. Let's just leave that. We'll let everyone please send in your
cleansing breath.
Your opinions.
Oh,
we'll still be friends after this, Alan. That's fine.
Of course we will. You know what? If you can't have passionate debates,
meaningful,
you know, then what's the point? I mean, it. Because honestly, let's face it, the sun's still coming up tomorrow. It's still setting. We still have jobs and families and responsibilities. Whether we're right or wrong, either way, it doesn't affect the outcome of our lives.
No, not at all. Not at all. Especially since we'll never know the true answer here. You know, this is a debate that neither one of us can prove, you know, in any way, shape, or form completely.
Right. You know what?
It's all a matter of opinion.
This is what my wife hated about literature classes and writing papers and why she gravitated toward math. Because she's like, math has answer. 2 + 2 is always 4. It's 2 + 2. There is an answer. There is a process. You can get to an answer. And I said, well, but I can argue Hamlet is
not
insane.
When you get into advanced math.
Stop with your – I hate when you do that. And I say, well, but see, honey, you use supporting information. I can prove Hamlet's insane based on X, Y, or Z, but I can also prove Hamlet is cunning and pretending to be insane. She goes, it can't be both. And I'm like, yes, it can, as long as I argue it with supporting material. So I just argued my view with my supporting material. You gave your view. That drives her bananas.
Yes.
Because she's like, you both can't be right. I'm like, actually, we both can.
Can. Because this is all a matter of opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a matter of interpretation.
Yeah, I'd say that. It's more than opinion. It's definitely interpretation. I agree. It's not just opinion, because anybody can have an opinion. That doesn't mean it's an informed opinion or an educated one. But I think we are looking at it more from a perspective of movie watchers. And so we can argue with a little bit more, I don't know, gravitas.
Right. It's really funny. 10 minutes, an hour ago, someone sent me something that's really funny that is very apropos to what we just said. It's okay. It says a fact is information minus emotion. An opinion is information plus experience. Ignorance is an opinion lacking information. And stupidity is an opinion that ignores a fact. Yeah, there
I
you go.
I wonder who posted that. That sounds real familiar.
It wasn't from you.
I posted that on my Facebook page today.
Did you really?
I did.
That's really funny.
I swear to God, I did today.
I did not see it on your Facebook page. That is really funny. Someone, I guess, you see, it made it all around the world.
Look, it did. It made it at least an 8-hour time difference.
Seven, but yeah.
Seven. Well, geez, you always got to correct me. What are you, my wife?
Yes.
I've already got one of those.
So do I. It's fine. You know. As much as I love her, I don't understand why people wanted more than one at some point in their lives.
I am with you on that.
Exactly. That's really funny I really didn't know that you also posted that.
I thought you were doing sort of a tongue in cheek saying, by the way, this just came in and I saw this. I was like, oh, you're repeating what I posted earlier.
Nope. Not at all.
That's bananas. Well, that's cool, but it is apropos.
Yes.
You know, you could have an opinion, but it's either it could be an informed opinion because you've got some kind of experience or knowledge, but just an opinion lacking any kind of knowledge, well, that's not really smart.
That's right.
That's ignorant.
That's correct. And first of all, I mean, trying to go back to what we were just talking about without going into that whole debate again, you know, I love the way that Hans is like, you know, moving the gun with his hand. You know, he's sort of like, you know, twisting his, you know, like doing exercises with his wrist while he's holding the gun. You know, the way that that he, you know, he puts it like a circular motion and then places it on the table as he's doing it, which is just very funny. The way that that he does it, you know, just swivels around like that. And
by the way, this is a very important thing that shows that Alan Rickman comes from a little bit of a theater background.
And then he's a lefty.
Because the thing that's I don't know if it matters if he's lefty or righty, but in theater, because you can't control where someone's looking, because the audience can look at the whole stage the whole time, that actors are taught, you know, if you're going to move, if you're going to have a motion, move on a line. So when you're done, you can then stop moving, which means the next person who's talking, the focus goes to the other actor. So you don't steal from them doing something that's distracting. You want to make sure you move on your line, or you have an action on your line. And if you look, he times his comment with the gun that by the time he's done with his line, he's got the gun pretty much down on the table.
Yes.
It's beautiful.
Yes,
it's
very true.
It's like, it's almost like it's meant to go completely together. And I love it. It shows a very talented. And it's subtle. Like someone may be for the first time going, I never noticed that. But that's what makes some performances stand out. It's the subtle things you might not realize that subconsciously add to that kind of menace and performance that Alan is just perfect at here in this movie.
Yes. There's absolutely no question about that. So John then shoots back and says, Hans, this asshole is not my friend. I just met him tonight. I don't know him. Jesus Christ, Ellis. These people are going to kill you. Tell them you don't know me. And Ellis then just, you know, laughs it off. But at this point, this is the point where I will agree with you. At this point, Ellis knows that he's in trouble. And his laugh is a half-assed type of laugh. Because he now knows he's in trouble. You know, he's smart enough to realize that he's in trouble. Now, first of all, I like the fact that John, this minute, he calls Ellis both a shithead and an asshole. You know, he's trying to convince Hans by, you know, disparaging Ellis. You know, you wouldn't talk to a friend that way when you think that they might be in danger. You know, that type of thing. You would try to do whatever you can to. So this is where we're going to go, a place where you don't expect us to go. All right. Where do you think the exclamation of Jesus Christ comes from as a, you know, as a curse or as some sort of interjection?
Right.
We're not obviously going into the religious aspects of it, you know. So where do you think that comes from?
I know growing up Catholic, I was told you're not supposed to take the Lord's name in vain. It's one thing to say damn, but if you put God in front, or if you say JC, you know, like that somehow is a bad sin. So I'm not
wait,
sure.
JC is okay?
No,
JC
Jesus,
is okay, or
no saying.
Oh, you're saying if you say the whole thing.
Yeah,
oh,
okay. If you say it as
I wasn't implying, I wasn't making you try and say something.
I thought
you were using that as.
For clarity, and it confused me as a child because I could say, "We are now going to say a prayer to Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior," and like, okay, that's fine. But if I go, "Jesus Christ," I stub my toe. Like, oh, that's a swear word. Well, we just said Jesus Christ in church. Well, it's your intention, how you chose to say it. One was reverently and one was as a curse, you're saying it irreverently. I was like, oh, so suddenly the same word can mean two different things depending on my intention. So that always cues me as a kid.
Okay.
But as far as it being an expletive or being something that you would evoke, I have no idea, honestly. I never even thought about when did it evolve to be something that you just exclaim when you're either frustrated or angry or hurt.
So first of all, we're actually going to use the term Jesus H. Christ, because that's usually what people use when they're, you know, when they're swearing or say an interjecting and stuff like that. So it is an expletive interjection that refers to the Christian religious figure of Jesus Christ. It is typically uttered in anger, surprise, or frustration. They're sometimes also with humorous intent. The expressions Christ, Jesus and Jesus Christ are also used as exclamations or expletives in English-speaking Christian-influenced mm-hmm. societies. Okay, so he knows when people started using it in this particular way. But in Mark Twain's autobiography, he gives a little story about something that happened when in 1847 when he was working as a teacher's apprentice. Okay, so it says that Twain recounts a practical joke a friend played on a revival preacher when Twain was an apprentice in the printing shop that Alexander Campbell, a famous evangelist, then visiting Hannibal, hired to print a pamphlet of his sermon. While checking the galleys, Twain's fellow apprentice, Wales McCormick, found he had made room for some dropped words, which he managed by shortening Jesus Christ on the same line to JC. As soon as Campbell had read the proofs, he swept indignantly into the shop and commanded McCormick, "So long as you live, don't you ever diminish the Savior's name again. Put it all in." The puckish McCormick obeyed, and then some. He set Jesus H. Christ and printed up all the pamphlets.
Oh my gosh, that's funny. So he got reprimanded for shortening the Lord's full name to a traveling evangelical. And so he goes, all right, fine, I want his full name. H. We'll put an H in there. Give him a middle initial. I wonder what exactly. H stood for when he first came up with Jesus H.
We're going to get there, Alan. Don't worry. Okay. I do my research.
You know, here's the thing. I use that phrase a lot. I'll put the H in there, but I've never thought about what does the H stand for.
Well, in a few minutes, you'll know. And okay, good. I don't know if that's going to make you want to say it more or say it less. Who knows? So it's actually known as a specifically American profanity. So anyone who doesn't live in America that's listening to this, if you are confused about this type of expletive, and you know, I'm curious to know if that is true, that people outside of America don't use that particular thing. And it is based on a little bit of research. It's primarily uttered only by men. You know, so I don't know if that's true or not. It sounds like it might make sense, but who knows? Okay, so part of the whole thing is adding the H is because you change the stress pattern when you're talking. The H is a higher stress than the other one. You would say Jesus H Christ, not Jesus mm-hmm. H Christ, you know, that type of thing. So basically there are a number of opinions as to why it's like this. So it's saying that the fact that this term has lasted so long might have a lot to do with its cadence and the way that an especially strong stress can be placed on the H. You might also think of it as an example of emphatic infixing that loosely fits the models of words like abso-bloody-lutely or tribu-bloody-lation. And, you know, we could, you know, go on and on about, you know, adding words inside, you know, adding expletives mm-hmm. in the middle of words to try to fix that. Okay. So a linguist named Dwight Bollinger mentions that Jesus H. Christ, in a discussion of the strategies used by English speakers to add additional stresses to highly charged words for purpose of emphasis, the strong emphasis on the H somehow improves the rhythm of its host phrase. So there's the dictionary of slang known as the Green's Dictionary of Slang that it says the H is redundant other than the rhythm, meaning it doesn't need to be there, but the reason it's there is because it helps with the rhythm of the way that you're cursing, I guess you can say. Mm-hmm. So where's the etymology of the H?
Yeah.
So the symbol is derived from the divine monogram, okay, which is the name of Jesus Christ, okay? And it comes from the Greek name of Jesus, which I don't know Greek, so I can't really pronounce what it says here, but it's transliterated as iota eta sigma. Okay, which can look like an IHS or an IHC mm-hmm. or a JHS or a JHC, because you know we all know from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you know, Jehovah is spelled with an I, not with a J, so you know, it still works the same way. So you have these three letters that looks like there's an H in the middle, even though there really isn't. It's just because of the Greek way that it's that it's spelled. Gotcha. Now. There are some false etymologies as to where this possibly came from. So they claim that this is where the H comes from. The fact that, you know, on the the Divine Monogram, you have the Greek letters, and that's where it looks like there's an H there. Okay, but there are popular false etymologies, including one that one commonly held origin is an initial for the name Harold, which is mentioned as the basis of the variant form Jesus Harold Christ. Okay, the Harold may arise from a common misinterpretation, often by children, of the phrase in the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." Right, the phrase can be mistakenly interpreted as specifying the name of the deity, rather than the true reading, which is "May thy name be hallowed." The confusion would arise from the phonetic similarity of "hallowed" to "Harold." You know, I've seen that in movies also. Name. Exactly, "Harold be thy name." So you'd have the H in the middle. Okay, there are obviously numerous variations of what people would use. You have Jesus Holy Christ, Jesus Hecking Christ, Jesus H Particular Christ, Jesus H Crow, Jesus H Johnson, Jesus A Mahogany Christ, Jesus Hopping Christ, Jesus Johnny Cake Christ, Jesus K Christ, Jesus X Christ, JH Christ, and Judas H Christ. Okay.
But you're leaving out my favorite, which I use all the time, Jesus H. Christ on a popsicle stick.
Oh, of course. Of course. I've heard that one. I've actually heard that one. It's not listed in this article, so I forgot about that.
It's all right.
You know, so all right. You got the interjection on your own.
I like Harold. That's cool. I was also thinking, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, that maybe that's where it was Harold. But could I be. Also thought maybe it was going to be heavenly, and that the irony was going to be, well, Jesus, heavenly Christ. It's not bad if you say it that way, right?
Correct. Exactly. So one last thing I want to say about this. So in this article, it suggests that the H offers the power of taking the Lord's name in vain by adding something to it that the imagination is invited to complete. You know, so what does the H actually stand for? Whatever the errant imagination proposes and the imaginer is disposed to enjoy. So it could be anything.
I love it.
You know,
love it.
Yeah.
I
knew you wouldn't expect that. Thing.
Because Shakespeare was good at that. So I love that it's a cadence that is just saying Jesus Christ sounds like too short. Like Jesus H. Christ. Like, it just makes it even more emphatic.
Correct. Especially when you go Jesus H. Christ on a popsicle stick. I'd forgotten about that one. Thank you for reminding me of that because it's.
Sure.
I'm trying to remember where I heard it from. There's a movie with it that is very prominent. I can't remember what it is. Yeah. It's not that.
I wonder if those phrases are like adding something like that was a way to soften it to say, well, I wasn't really swearing because I said on a popsicle stick.
Right. Could be. Could be.
Who knows?
We will never know. But it's fun to think about it. Right. So at this point, we definitely see Ellis sweating. He knows and he's beginning to understand that this negotiation that he has tried has failed. But he still doesn't even expect any type of repercussions for it because what he does is he slinks back and he smirks and then he picks up his glass of Coke. And at the same time, we see that Hans, you know, starts raising the gun. And Ellis, you know, he's like chuckling and just starts to, you know, to put the glass to his to his mouth. But right before he does this, he basically says to John, you know, John, how can you say that after all these years? John, you know, and that's actually the point where, you know, he loses it. He just knows that this is over. He's tried, he's done his best, but that's it. You know, but he doesn't realize what Hans is really capable of. Even though they know that Takagi's dead. But, you know, the question is, do you think people heard the gunshot of Takagi? Besides John, obviously.
I doubt it, because it was too many floors up above them.
Exactly. So the idea is that they know he's supposedly dead, but no one's seen his body.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, from a filmmaking perspective, with the score, something we mentioned from time to time, if you notice, there hasn't been much in the way of music through this back and forth until after he kind of does the whole shot. I gave it my best guess.
Yeah.
I tried. And all of a sudden you hear, doo, 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 and the soundtrack comes back. And you realize, someone's plucking on some strings. So all of a sudden we've got a little musical interlude as Hans is picking the gun back up.
Yeah, for sure. And I love the fact also that we hear the gunshots, not in the room. We hear it from John, John, because then we also get to see John's expression as this is happening. You can clearly see that he is distraught, that he knows that he tried his best. He did what he could, but it just doesn't, it didn't work. Because he knows
No.
that Ellis, I guess now we can say, was an idiot. He's no longer an idiot. Now, what happens to that glass of Coke? They must have stained the carpet in Holly's office. Besides the blood,
I'm sure there was more than just a Coke sting.
And what happens to the rest of the can? I mean, they didn't fill up the whole cup, the whole glass with Coke. So I don't know. To me, it's a waste. That's what I'm saying. It's a waste of Coke Classic. I'm like a firm believer that if you're drinking Coke, you got to drink it from a glass. You can't drink from a paper cup. Can't drink from a plastic cup. It's got to be glass. I have a glass in my glove compartment for that very reason.
Really?
Yes.
Now, see, I'm okay with hard plastic. Like, I use a Nalgene water bottle for making sure I've always got water with me. But I know my wife is much more about this with beer, likes beer in bottles versus cans. And that if we have to get cans for some reason, like let's say we have extras because we're going to the beach or the lake where you're not supposed to have glass, when we get back extras, she'll want to pour that then into a glass. She
Okay,
prefers it
I can
from a
understand that.
glass.
Right. I mean, I discussed this last season when we were talking about Plane, Trains, and Automobiles, when we were talking about the glove compartment. So the main reason I keep a glass there is because when I go to the movies, I will fill up the glass with Coke. I don't like drinking from the plastic cups in the movie theater. For me, Coke has got
That's
to be in a glass.
crazy.
I went to see, hey, I'm crazy. What can I tell you? I went to see Jaws last week, and it because they had a showing. So I was able to see it in the theater, which I'd never seen in the theater before because, I was one when it came out. And that would have been really, really a bad thing if my parents took me to see Jaws when I was one. I think they would have put them in jail at that point. But so I'm sitting there in the middle of the movie and I take out my glass and I pour the Coke from from the movie cup into my glass just to be able to enjoy it even more. I'm crazy, I
Wow.
know, but why not? You
I
seemed
want to go
speechless for a
back to
second
the,
there.
well, I was because I was trying to make sure that I put a pause to make it look like I cared about what you were saying. And now I'm moving on to something else. So I want to talk camera movement for a second because it's so subtle that I almost didn't notice it until going back and kind of rewatching the medium shot of John McClane. Against the, in an unlit floor of the building, the only light coming in from outside windows, so he tends to be only half lit on his outside edge. When he starts off the first monologue, the camera is slowly pushing. He's in a medium shot, and by the time it goes back, after he's like, I put Hans back on the line, this head doesn't know you, but I know what kind of, and it comes back, and the camera has moved in the whole time. His intensity of delivering the lines, the camera's getting closer and closer and closer. It ends on the exact close up, and then we leave, come back to Ellis. We come back to, the reverse behind Ellis's head showing Alan Rickman's character, grabbing the gun. And then it comes right back exactly where the camera left off for him to react to that shot. So we are right up in his face. Even though we left it, we were gone for just a few seconds. It's so immediate to be right there, half lit. And you get his little blink reaction to hearing the gunshot, just makes it feel like we're
Yeah.
feeling like he's feeling.
Wow.
And it's really, the visually helps emotionally tell what John
Yeah, for
was doing.
sure. And I mean, I noticed now also when I'm looking at it, I love how you can see his reflection behind him in the glass. Because if there's no lights there and it's almost completely dark, so what is reflecting? What is causing his ref us to see his reflection in the glass? Is it the light outside? Is it the is there Is it something that Jan de Bont put on the side that is lighting John up a little bit? So we see like the sweat on his brow also at the same time.
Yeah, he's got the shine. I definitely think it's either the spotlights or the combination of just lights from LA coming in through a skyscraper building. But it's so stark. But we don't realize how the camera has slowly pushed in with the intensity of John McClane recognizing. Because remember yesterday how he was going very slowly, very methodically. In fact, actually earlier this week when he got caught with his name, where he realized Hans now knows his name.
Right.
It's very slow. He's thinking. You know, you can tell his mind goes 1,000 miles an hour, but it's this minute when it's starting to, you know, he realizes Ellis doesn't get it. I got to do everything I can. And the intensity is just now all of a sudden that spinning wheel that was in his head becomes how fast his delivery of those lines. And it becomes like you just feel the tension building. Like you just know what's coming.
Yeah, for sure. Now, here, I'm gonna throw this question out at you. Do you think that what John did here was really something that could have saved Ellis?
I think it's entirely possible that if he could have gotten Ellis to shut up sooner and admit that he was just, you know, trying to figure something out, it's possible, although Hans might have gotten just as angry about being lied to. So, I mean, I don't know. I think John McClane was in a no-win scenario. And I mean, he didn't want to give up. He was still trying to figure out how to save Ellis, but I think he knew that there was probably no way Ellis was walking out of this now.
Right. I mean, the fact that Hans believes from the start that Ellis is friends with John already put Ellis in enough danger.
Correct.
You know, so as you said, to push him away and say that, okay, this guy is just lying, that just gives Hans another reason to kill him. He's not going to kill him now because he's a friend of John's. He's going to kill him because, you know, I don't need someone who's just going to come and lie to me.
Right.
Because he also knows that Ellis is half lying because Ellis does know something. See, I think that's a mistake that Hans makes here. You know, the fact that he executes Ellis so quickly that instead of trying to, you know, gather information from Ellis, because Ellis knows who John is.
Right. No, that's a good point.
You know, so he should have tried to maybe torture him or threaten him in some way to be able to get information. We discussed earlier this week the fact that he could have just, you know, blurted out, oh, Tali. Mm-hmm. You know, he could have done that.
Right.
Obviously, the movie would be a lot shorter if that's what he did. But,
yeah, you're right.
So I'm glad that they didn't do that.
It is a mistake on his part. I also was going to ask you what your thoughts are. What if, let's go all the way back earlier in the week, what if when Hans goes, or should I say McClane, Officer John McClane of the New York Police Department, if he had gone, I have no idea what you're talking about, Hans, would Hans have suddenly doubted Ellis?
That's very possible.
And is it possible that because he was taken off guard, and that's the very first time we saw where John's not in control of the situation, even when the next act against him, you still always sense every scene he's got a way out. Here's his one time where he doesn't know a way out, and that's his mistake. He admits, yeah, that is who I am, and that gave credibility to Ellis.
But going back to what we discussed earlier this week, the fact that John thought it might be Holly there,
right? So he had to admit,
could also be one of the reasons why his first thought is, okay, it's Holly. Right. So I can't deny at this point.
Right. No, that's a good point, because if he is thinking the only reason you know my name is you figured out Holly, that may be why he admitted it. It's fun to play that game, the what if. Like, where was the fatal mistake made? I think the fatal mistake was Ellis walking in the room thinking he can negotiate.
Yes. Yes. But they had to get rid of him. You know, Ellis, he just, you know, the whole reason Ellis is in this movie is for the scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know.
You know, he hasn't done anything else productive in the movie besides snorting coke every chance he gets.
You know what I do like about it is, because these kinds of movies generally, or the knockoffs, add characters just to kill them for the sake of like the spectacle of killing. What I like is it's still a motivated killing. It still advances the storyline. It does, from the action thriller perspective, Hans does use it. He does which we'll get to. I know we haven't gotten to it yet, but the screams, the crowd, the terror, he uses it to really continue to build the fear and terror of his hostages so he can control them.
Which is why he is known as a terrorist, as opposed to a thiefist.
After all your posturing, you're just a common, ordinary thief.
I'm an exceptional thief. And now that I'm moving up to kidnapping, you should be more polite.
Great line. That's the other thing. A good movie that stays with you for a long time has really good quotable lines.
Yes.
It gets the audience reliving movie scenes when you get together and you say, oh, remember that? Remember when he said this and when she said this? And that's what I think keep a movie enduring past when it was first released.
Yes, completely. I completely agree with you on that. So at this point, we then get a shot after we see John during the shooting of, or the assumed shooting of Ellis. See, that would have been a good fake also if he wouldn't have actually shot him. Mm-hmm. He could have tried to do that too, because we don't see the shooting on screen. You know, later on we'll see his head dripping blood. But, you know, the idea is that Hans could have faked it. He could have, just shot in the air, and John would have still thought they shot Ellis in order to try and get something from him. Who knows? But he didn't do that. So what can I tell? Then we get a panning shot of the crowd outside, there's a lot of chaos because there's all this screaming, and we can see that everyone's scared and stuff like that. And then the camera basically stops on Holly for a few seconds, and we see that she is shocked. You know, she didn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think that she would have anticipated that when Ellis said, you know, I'm not going to sit around and wait and see if who's going to get us killed first, your husband or them. You know, that she didn't realize that Ellis was signing his own death warrant by doing that. You know, she's still genuinely shocked that Hans went through with it and killed him.
Mm-hmm. I also think, and although we don't see it, remember the very first time we get a headshot is earlier, but it's private. It's up in Takagi's office.
Well, no, it's in the conference room.
And we hear Takagi was killed. Or yeah, his conference room. Well, isn't it the office, his office outside the conference room, because it was his personal computer they wanted him to log into?
No, it wasn't his personal computer.
The headshot that we as an audience watch, the audience that is watching, we saw the blood splatter hit the window. I wonder, although we don't see it later, is she reacting to the fact that you hear somebody gets killed, you're like, okay, did she see Elk get killed? And the reaction becomes much more visceral because you're seeing it happen.
Right. Well, in the movie, we don't see that. You know, we just see their reaction to the whole thing. I guess they wanted to save a little bit of, squib work of putting all this fake blood on another window.
Yeah.
You know, I guess they said one is enough.
It does make you wonder where the blood splatter went, because I don't think you ever see – I think you see blood on the ground maybe, but I'm trying to remember now. See, and this is the detail where you got to slow the movie down.
You see blood on the ground, and you see blood on the chair because you see his head. Okay. You see his head just from the back where he's just oozing blood.
So the audience there, because there are kind of slit windows, very well could have seen, or at least some people have seen, someone's, you know, back of the head, you know, blown out.
Right. And then Hans calmly just stands up, you know, even after having done what he just did, he just calmly stands up, takes the gun into his hand, you know, moves it from one hand to the other, walks calmly to the door, has his radio, and, you know, I guess pushes the talk to speak button, opens the door, and raises his hand outside so that John and the police and everyone else listening in, even Argyle down in the parking garage, can hear the screaming of everybody, you know. And what I wonder is, how does Hans get to the door so quickly? I mean, I think Holly's office has more than one door because he walks to the side and immediately goes out the door. He doesn't, you know, have to go via via Ginny's desk, which is where, you know, originally we've seen everyone enter the room through that other door. You know, we saw Holly and Alyssa Devine enter through there when they met Ginny. And we saw John came in there with Takagi, you know, when they caught Ellis.
I think you're right.
In his coat.
Because there's not a name on the door when he opens it. And we know that when they came in the one side. Right. When we came in the one side, it had her title. Because remember, he looked at it and saw that her name on the door
Gennaro.
Was not McLean. Right.
Right.
So she probably has a main entrance and then a private entrance exit.
Right.
But interesting. I never thought about it being two separate doors, but I think you're right.
Yeah. And what's funny is that the main entrance goes into the hallway. The private entrance goes into the lobby, which you think it would be the opposite. You know, like, why would you need a private entrance to go into the lobby? You know,
Well, see, the script called for him to be able to do this.
Yes. Yes. That goes without saying.
But no, you're right. Architecturally speaking, when you look at it, it doesn't make sense because they had to go around the hall and the side door to get to her office. But now here's the private open entrance, and it's into the main area where everyone's being
kept. Yes, for sure.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I never – there you go. You got me on one. I never thought about the architectural layout of her office before. Now I'm going to have to go back and rewatch to see if we have any other indication based on where he is, if there are two doorways into her office.
Well, there's the point where he thrusts Carl up against the window and they can all see it, but you don't see that there's a door there. It's the window that they're all looking at.
It almost makes you wonder, from a filmmaking perspective, depending what they needed in the shot, they used two different offices.
It could be. We'll have to track down.
Because, you know, it goes by so quickly, we don't know. Yeah, we'll get him. Get Jan de Bont on the phone. Say, we got a question. We need answering, and only you can help us with this.
That's right. Or Rick Tiernan also, possibly. If he's on parole this week. Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Well, he won't if he hears that.
Well, I know he's still flying around the world because apparently back in the end of July, he was in England for a film festival where he was introducing this movie. So, gotcha. You know, unfortunately, I wasn't in England at the time. So, no, missed that one. If I hadn't known, maybe I would have, you know, done a stopover back in England. Who knows? But probably not. Who knows? Maybe he'll come to Israel one day. So you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the slight variations in the script?
No, you know what I love about what we've established this week is we've seen John and Hans already playing a little cat and mouse, and the game got up to this week when John got outed by Ellis. And I think what I love about the movie is it's constantly that cat and mouse. And who's going to make the first mistake and who's going to get caught and who's going to outthink, outtalk, manipulate their way out of the situation. And I think even coming up, because at some point you have an actual confrontation where the movie constantly is one upping the idea of these two people constantly playing cat and mouse with one another and trying to figure out how to outmaneuver the other and who's going to capture, who's going to get, who's going to cut them off, who's going to keep them quiet. It really is the driving force of everything else in the movie is real Hans and John's interaction.
Yes.
Even when they're not on the same screen, it's the two main characters. They're foils. They're basically foils to each other. Everything that happens is motivated by the fact that these two keep crossing.
Yes. Yeah. And they're both stopping the other one from continuing with their plan. John's plan is to get out of the building mm-hmm. and Hans's plan is to blow up the building, you know, similar
types and make themselves 20%.
Yes, earn 20%. Mm-hmm. Right. So
that's it. This has been a great week, and I know we're going to wrap up on. You got some things on the script, but just in general, this to me is just one of those nice. It's a great 5 minutes of storytelling where you don't have to have it always be action to be intense. To feel the. You know, on the edge of your seat. You know, it's the thriller of the action thriller. And I love that. The fact that we could be sitting there holding our breath when there's not a lot of action, but we know a lot's happening psychologically.
Yes, sure. For sure. Okay. So the script has a few descriptive aspects that I liked. Okay. So when Hans says to John, good, then you'll give us what we want and save your friend's life. You're not part of this equation. It's time to realize that. And then it says, saying this, Hans takes a gun, points it at Ellis, smiling. Ellis smiles back. Then Ellis says, what am I? A method actor, Hans? Babe, put away the gun. This is radio, not television. So that, in my opinion, it goes back to a bit from before. It at least proves to me that according to the script, you know, since Ellis is smiling back at Hans, you know, it's part of the ploy.
I would argue that he's smiling because he's too stupid to realize he means. He's like, come on, man, what are you doing? You don't have to bring out a gun. I don't think he's doing it for John's benefit. I think he's just trying to say, hey, Hans, you don't need a gun. And that – anyway, we already rehashed that, but okay.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I know. I just wanted to point that out. Okay, so – and McLean says that asshole is not my friend. I barely know him. So first of all, you know, the fact that he – in the movie, he says this asshole. As opposed to that asshole, right? And then he goes, I barely know him. I hate his guts. Ellis, for Christ's sakes, tell him you don't mean to me. So it's a little more intense with what's mm-hmm. written in the script as opposed to what actually happens in the movie itself. I like that it's a little more toned down in the movie. I think that works better, okay? Then it says, Ellis looks at Hans and shrugs. Well, I tried. Hans nods understandingly. He takes the CB, presses the dark button, and in one frighteningly smooth motion, brings the Walther up to Ellis's forehead and pulls the trigger. So in the script, you actually see it. And then it says, you know, then we cut to McClane, and it says he was expecting the shot, but it still chills him. And then Holly and the hostages on the in the lobby of the 30th floor, she lowers her head sadly. Around her, the others go crazy as they see Ellis's blood splattered on the glass walls of Hans's office. Hans then throws open the door to let McClane at least hear the screams of the hostages. Mm-hmm. So it goes back to what you were saying, that they don't show the blood, but in the script, they meant to.
And then this goes back to my other comment I talked about with, you know, you don't want to use the same gag more than once if you can help it. We've already seen the header on the window. We just can, I think, assume that's the same effect. We don't need to see it again. The audience fills it in their heads.
Right. Correct. Which I like that they do it that
way. I do, too. I think it's efficient because we've seen it once. We don't need to see it again just for the sake of gratuity. We've seen it. So now we know in our heads, speaking of heads, we know in our minds what's just happened.
Right. But even more than that, I think it makes the scene more impactful when you're just imagining it as opposed to having to see it.
I totally agree. I think more than can happen in your mind.
That's right. And at the same time, we see John's reaction to it, you know, which is supposed to mirror our own reactions to it, you know, like a grimace that, if only I would have, you know, been able to try and stop that. Mm-hmm. So I like the way that they do that. I think it works. I definitely think it works. So because John couldn't make it to the show today, so every Friday, the segment that I have is, you know, my weekend surprise segment, which you've already answered, and we've already talked about it today, how this movie is related to Christmas. But just for anyone listening, John sent me his opinion, so I'm going to actually read his opinion on this. So one of the biggest controversies about Die Hard is Die Hard considered a Christmas movie or not? So here's – I'm going to read off John's answer. It says, I think Die Hard is not a Christmas film. I hold this opinion despite knowing full well it's in the minority of perceived wisdom. Here is my reasoning. I'm accustomed to Christmas films featuring snow and redemption. While there is a white powder-like substance in this movie, it ain't one of a meteorological nature. Good Christmas movies might have the weather hampering a character's travel. Here, not a concern, unless you count the snow of shattered glass ripping up the feet of our hero. A lot of talk of snow here. Some of it may be a cultural bias. I come from a country where snow is a complete rarity, so I have internalized the Northern Hemisphere idea of Christmas. The movie also has no pernicious miser or institution exploiting the little guy. Nakatomi is definitely no Grinch or Scrooge. And last, McClane's marriage is not miraculously saved by his heroism, or at least his redemption was already in train when he took the step of flying out to the West Coast. McClane hasn't learnt to treat people any differently, hasn't suddenly increased his humanity. He would always have befriended Al, always correctly labeled the Ellis of the worlds as trash, and always gone to his own cigarettes. So thank you, John, for your opinion on that. You're correct. You are in the minority of all of my guests so far. And I see on Alan's face that he wants to give his rebuttal. So
I just want to react. In L.A., you don't get snow. So we do get a scene at the end after the Christmas miracle. It's a snow of paper falling, and it's used throughout the entirety of the end of the movie to show us that the clarity – you can't get snow, but the paper represents the snowfall happening at the end of the movie.
Yes.
You said there's no Scrooge character. I've never heard that every Christmas movie to be considered a Christmas movie has to have a miser. But if we do, why wouldn't the miser be the person who's trying to ruin everyone's Christmas? I would argue Hans is there to ruin everyone's Christmas. He bashes into the middle of a Christmas party. And last but not least,
I would actually argue that Takagi
does, in fact.
I would actually argue that Takagi is the Scrooge Grinch because he's making all of his employees.
We talked about this.
He's making his employees.
They're not working on a Saturday. We talked about the date. This is a Friday after
work. No,
they were already there.
No, forget about that. I'm not talking about Saturday. I'm not. I know we did, but I'm not talking about that. I'm saying he's forcing his employees to show up on Christmas Eve to a party. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter what day of the week it is.
for a Christmas party. Okay, so maybe he's a little miserly-ish, but honestly, if you're looking for someone to ruin Christmas, obviously you can argue that Hans is. And finally, redemption. Yes, because John does say to Al, when this is done, I got a bad feeling. You need to find my wife. I can't tell you how, but by then you'll know how. He then admitted right there on the air, you know, my wife's heard me say I love you 1,000 times, but she's never heard me say I'm sorry. There's your redemption.
So thank you for that rebuttal.
Boom!
Thank you for that rebuttal.
You need me on every episode. No, you know why I'm so good at rebutting? Because my wife refuses. All the evidence I lay out, the case, the argument, it doesn't matter. In her mind, no, you don't have killing in a Christmas movie. End of line.
Okay. All right, Alan.
And I have a hard time figuring out how to overcome that one.
I think you're just supposed to just let it snow.
Let it snow. I think this is one of those times where I have to realize I can be right and I can still be oh so wrong.
Yes, yes. As all of us married men know. Yeah.
Been there, done that, closet full of t-shirts.
Exactly. So, Alan, you want to once again, for the final time this week, tell everyone how they can find or get in touch with Alan Sanders.
Sure. If you would like to do something similar, like you are enjoying the breakdown of a movie 1 minute at a time, me and my co-host Walt Murray started The Wilder Ride a few years ago. We looked at the movies of Gene Wilder. In season one, we broke down Young Frankenstein. Season two, we did Blazing Saddles. Things changed thanks to the cold that went around the world for a couple of years, and we changed it into a talk show. And then my buddy got remarried, and I haven't seen him since. So I have no idea where The Wilder Ride's going, but the nice thing is all that content is evergreen. You've got four packed full season content to go through. If you want to find me, just look for Alan J. Sanders on Twitter. I do tend to have a job in news talk, so I tend to be a news talk person. So if that bothers you, if you have a hard time separating culture with news of the day, maybe stick with The Wilder Ride. Otherwise, you can find The Alan Sanders Show wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
All right. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you might be using to listen to this show. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. Or you can go directly to my website, movierobminute.com. So, Alan, thank you very much for filling in at the last minute for these last 3 days. It's been a lot of fun. And hopefully all the people listening are having as much fun as you and I have had.
It is a sheer pleasure to be back to bat from the bullpen or to pitch from the bullpen or to be called up from the minors.
To pitch from the bullpen?
To pitch. Sorry. So I was maybe pitching and pitching, but to pitch from the bullpen or be called up from the minors. But, dude, I said this to you last time. Anytime if you're at the last second, you know you can always call on me. I don't need any show prep. I don't need anything. Just tell me the minute we're going to talk about and I'm ready to go. I love love, love this movie. It's one of my perennial favorites. It is a movie I watch at least once a year. The nice thing for those people who don't think it's a Christmas movie, you don't have to wait for Christmas to watch it. It works any time of year. So that's a perennial favorite here in the household, but it's also one I'll probably watch 2-3 times a year when there's nothing else on.
All right. Very good. All right. So until Monday, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!